Welcome to the Bicast, a podcast for the bisexual community. We continue our discussion on Sappho. Joining us is Ellie Moss of Bisexual Books on Tumblr. Welcome.
Welcome.
Hello.
I'm John.
Hi there, I'm Eileen.
I'm Lynette.
And I'm Ellie Moss.
Oh, we're so happy to have you on.
Yes. So Ellie, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm one of the editors at the Bisexual Books Tumblr. My bachelor's was actually in classical studies, which is the study of the ancient world with a focus on the Latin and Greek languages. So I was especially interested in Sappho as a topic. And my master's is in library science, and now I'm working at a community college library.
That is so fantastic.
Excellent.
I love libraries.
So what prompted you to write this really terrific piece on Sappho? I was really grateful for it because I referenced it so frequently when we did my segment on Sappho. I thought it was a really great piece, and I was just curious as to what prompted you to write it.
Well, this piece has been percolating almost since we started the blog. I mentioned earlier that I was a classical studies major. My graduating project was about how people retell mythology. And of course, in antiquity, people told and retold myths to mean different things as the culture and political landscape changed. And that continues to this day. And it's a topic that you can't really talk about without also talking about how we retell history. For example, I was very interested in the stories about Amazons and how it became very important in the 70s and actually even earlier to prove that Amazons represented actual historical matriarchal societies in the Mediterranean. And there's just no actual proof of that. It's the kind of things that make historians cringe, and then everyone avoids you at parties because you just want to talk about cultural context and methodology and that kind of stuff. So I have an interest in how people find meaning in history. And then people started talking about Sappho, and people started talking about Sappho on Tumblr. It wasn't long after coming to Tumblr that I started noticing all these conversations about Sappho and whether she represented bi women. And there were people who were really, really opposed to it because the lesbians had her first or something. And then people arguing that she was really bi, whatever that means in the context of ancient Greece. And then people started accusing bisexuals of appropriating Sappho. And
right.
Then I knew that we had to say something. I think queer historians have acknowledged for decades that you can't really talk about people in history being gay or transgender because those are modern Western concepts. Mm-hmm. But we can talk about people who have sex with others of the same gender or who have intense emotional relationships with others of the same gender. And we can talk about people who consistently defy gender binary norms or lived as a different gender than the one they were assigned. But it's not historically or accurate or culturally accurate to assign modern labels to those people. But it's still important to talk about these people, and because history is looking to the past to talk about the present. And if straight people get to look to the past, so should we. And if gay people get to look to the past, then so should we. Even if they didn't use the same words and even if or even have the same concepts as us. As our culture does now, it's important to acknowledge that there were people before us that lived as a different gender than they were assigned, or who had intense emotional and physical relationships with people of the same gender. Because it's actually important to us to find meaning in that history.
Right. We did touch on this a little bit in the last podcast, how it's not necessarily accurate to ascribe these labels. But it's also really important for us to have a sense of historical continuity. And when people talk about historical accuracy, it gets applied very strictly to bisexual people and not as often to other people. For example, people don't accuse people talking about gay historical figures of misunderstanding the historical context as frequently as bisexuals are accused of doing the same.
Right, exactly. As long as we acknowledge the cultural context, we frequently don't make gay people prove beyond the shadow of a doubt that someone would have totally used the word gay. Most people in history would not have. But yeah, as soon as we start talking about bisexuals in history, that bar gets raised. And suddenly you have to prove beyond the shadow of a doubt that no, really, they were really bi. And that definition of bi in these conversations is always changing. Like if you're arguing emotional relationships, then suddenly people want you to prove, no, they had to have had sex with people of more than one gender. And then you have to prove that they had a certain amount of relationships with people of more than one gender. And, you know, even modern definitions of bisexuality don't require this very exacting definition. But inevitably, these conversations about history and whether or not people in history were bisexual, it always comes back to that. And that's not fair. So you don't have to prove that Sappho would have used our meaning of the word lesbian, but you do have to prove that she would have used our meaning of the word bisexual. So I wanted to write this piece because I wanted to talk about how Sappho can still have relevance to modern day bisexuals. She still symbolizes something for us. And we aren't making up anything when we do this. We aren't destroying history in the process.
Great.
Well, we thank you for that.
Yeah, it's clear that you did a lot of research for this piece. Can you tell us the resources that you used?
Sure. We actually know very little about Sappho. We have some scraps that were saved in basically Roman poetry textbooks. We have what a handful of ancients wrote. We have an entry in a book that dates to the Middle Ages, and that's probably not accurate at all. And that was it for years, for centuries, until the late 19th century when people started translating the scraps of papyrus used to make Egyptian mummies in the Roman period. And every time we find a new scrap from those papyri, it's a huge deal. We actually just discovered a new one not very long ago. And it was so important because it was about her family. A few sources had always said she had had brothers, but we're talking about things that have been written centuries after her death. And this scrap of poetry that was found recently confirms that it's true. And it was so exciting. I can't even, like, we found something new in our lifetimes about Sappho. Like, we have real evidence about her family life. So I used, in my essay, a lot of what I used was an article from the Journal of Homosexuality by Anne Klink called Sleeping in the Bosom of a Tender Companion, Homoerotic Attachments in Sappho. And the purpose of this article was to reexamine evidence of homoeroticism in Sappho's poetry. She talks about historical references to Sappho's sexuality and how the poetry itself isn't actually very sexual. It's intense, but it's not carnal. It's not sexy. Like, she talks a lot about garlands of flowers and stuff. And so this is the piece that I used a lot in that paper. Her purpose for her article was not to prove that Sappho was bisexual. She actually never addresses that in her article, but she provided a lot of good evidence anyways. So what we know about Sappho, and I guess you probably talked about this earlier, she lived in the 1600s on the island of Lesbos. She wrote poetry. She was pretty famous for it. She wrote marriage poetry, but also religious poetry and poetry about her family. And a lot of this poetry proclaims her love for young women. She almost certainly ran a school for young women, and these women in the poetry were probably from that school. She came from a merchant family, or at least her brother was a merchant. She had a husband, probably a daughter, definitely those two brothers. And then what we have is from 100 years after her death, we have Ovid, who wrote this immensely entertaining, totally factually incorrect story about how she fell in love with a man who wouldn't have her, and then she threw herself off a cliff. And this story is almost certainly not true. Ovid is not what anyone would ever have called historically accurate.
Certainly not.
No. But the case for a queer Sappho by that point was pretty sound, even though we actually have no evidence of anyone talking about her sexuality for 800 years after her death, at least as far as the evidence that we have now. What we have is this 2nd or 3rd century CE papyrus, probably based off of Chameleon, and I might be mispronouncing that. But the actual work by Chameleon is lost to us. But this papyrus says, and it's a great quote, "She has been accused by some people of being licentious in her lifestyle and a woman lover." And it's a great quote.
Ooh.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And then there's the context that she's writing in. Greeks reading her poetry would have recognized the Greek theos system, school system. She had, like, the girl version of the theos system. It was common in Athens for men to take a younger boyfriend, usually a teenager. And this was an important part of training the young man for his adult public life. Athenian society was a democracy, and it's important to know the right people to be successful. And it could certainly be sexual. There was a lot of wooing going on. We have a lot of romantic poetry from that time period. But what's important to realize is that those boys were not what we would now call gay. They were expected to grow up and marry a wife and have some kids and be active in democracy and then maybe someday take a boyfriend or two. So, yeah, they were expected to grow up and marry a wife and have some kids and maybe someday take a boyfriend or two of their own. The system is sort of situationally bisexual. And it was the same with Sappho. She wrote poetry to these young women, but those young women would grow up and take a husband. In fact, a lot of her romantic poetry is marriage poetry. And so people reading in ancient Greece, reading Sappho, would have recognized that system.
Well, that's a really interesting point that we have to take a lot of this into the context of the society it was in, and we miss that a lot. We seem to go over that quite a bit in our, you know, in modern society.
Absolutely. Well, most of her poetry is written towards women, and we've talked about that. But some of it is actually written to men. A lot of her poetry is marriage poetry. But some of the poetry actually seems to be addressing men. And I actually have a sample here. "Sweet mother, I can't weave my web, overcome with longing for a boy because of slender Aphrodite."
Yes, we actually read that fragment in the last podcast.
Oh, good. Excellent.
Yeah, okay. I was happy to hear it again because I really love it. Thank you.
Some of her poetry doesn't actually reveal the gender of the person she's addressing. And part of that may be because what we have is a lot of fragments. A lot of her poetry is lost to us. But English as a language doesn't handle gender neutral very well. And that's not something we address very often, that sometimes we just don't know the pronouns in her poetry. When I read Klink's article on the subject, I had this moment where I was brought up short. Like, what? Because she flat out says, in one of her paragraphs, she flat out says that she's excluding any Sappho poetry that refers to heterosexual love. So she's excluding a lot of that marriage poetry in her article.
Really?
Yeah. I am excluding here the numerous fragments from the Epithalamia, for example, which obviously refer to heterosexual love. And then she talks about how she gives several examples of ambiguous gender in Sappho's poetry, and then actually gives two examples of changing the gender in translations. Can I read you that example?
Mm-hmm. Please do.
She says, "Fragment 126, may you sleep in the bosom of a tender companion, does not reveal the gender of the addressee, unless Dawis is Dawisa, the Aeolic feminine participle, rather than the optative." Well, if it's the participle, but it's not the feminine participle, that's not what's written. What we have written is an optative. So that's a sentence that gets translated differently into English. And then fragment 129b speaks of loving someone else more than me. Tin alun anthropone is masculine, but this may not be significant.
Okay.
And maybe it's not significant. The masculine is sometimes gender neutral.
Mm.
But that's quite a conclusion to jump to in what's just a fragment. It only makes sense if you're trying to avoid anything that might imply that some of her poetry was addressing men.
Right.
Right.
It is kind of a leap.
It's a leap.
Yeah. This kind of goes to the next question about feedback. What kind of feedback have you gotten since writing this article, positive and negative?
Most of what I've directly received has been positive. I know of at least one Tumblr response that linked to the article. It wasn't in one of the reblogs, but linked to it, and said that I was ruining Sappho by saying she's a pedophile because the girls in her poems are teenagers.
Okay.
And I did get that response to the article. And Klink actually addresses this at great length in her paper. Gosh, almost half the paper, I would say, was actually addressing this. There's a real attempt by some modern academics to prove that Sappho's relationships were with people of the same age as her. And this is an attempt to retell history, like we talked about earlier, in order to make Sappho into a good role model by current standards. It's not acceptable in our culture for adults to have relationships with young people. So in order for Sappho to be a good role model, she has to represent modern lesbianism. But she didn't. Klink uses historical evidence and actually evidence from the poetry itself to demonstrate that this poetry was written towards teenagers, which was socially acceptable when Sappho wrote it and is not now. But that's what we mean when we talk about not applying our modern definitions to people in other cultures and time periods.
Right. Very good point. What we perceive as being proper is not what is taken out of context of what was acceptable at the time.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So in terms of putting things in context and in terms of just many other things we've discussed here, what would you like to see happen when everyone talks about Sappho? The issue is really, as Lynette has put it, a landmine. It's very difficult to talk about. There are a lot of misconceptions that happen when people do discuss the subject. So what would you personally like to see happen in the discourse about Sappho?
It's totally a landmine. I would like to see the discussion move away from the talk of bi women stealing Sappho from lesbians as though she can't represent both of us.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, it's only stealing if you believe that she would have identified with either word in its modern definition. And, well, that's a moot point because we don't know what she would have identified with. And she was from a different, completely different culture, so she wouldn't have used either word in any case. If you want to talk historical context, I mean, bi women and lesbians used to make up the same queer women's community. Like, that split didn't happen until the second half of the 20th century. At the time when Sappho was becoming a symbol for queer women, and that was in the 19th century, like, she was representing all queer women. So, like, how do I think bi people should talk about her? She was a woman who wrote romantic poetry to other women, and sometimes other people. And this is something bi women identify with completely. So, mm-hmm. Of course, she symbolizes us. She symbolizes all queer women in that way.
Have to agree with you 100% on that. You know, and I did not realize that there was a split between the queer women during the 19th century. I for some reason I had always assumed that it was lesbian and bisexual women separate. But when after you know finding out about that, I went back and it's like, yeah, we were all together because a lot of these women were married.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Right. When we talk about a lack of historical continuity, we see a lot of discussion. We see a lot of use of the term lesbian in talking about lesbian activities, lesbian movements in the early 20th century, sometimes even in the 19th century. And bisexual women don't really appear until much later. And a lot of people seem to take from that that bisexual women weren't involved in activism, weren't involved in queer life, when that couldn't be farther from the truth.
Absolutely.
Very good point. Very good point. It was the way the language was used. It wasn't that we weren't there. It was just, it was not that separation of it.
Right. Well, there's a lot of, there's a lot of written on the salon culture, and especially in Paris and the Bohemians here. And really, you go back to some of these people, you see there's relationships with men and women. And, you know, I was reading a piece on Walt Whitman a while back, talking about some of his relationships with women. And, you know, he's someone who is claimed as a gay man by the gay movement. And, you know, I didn't really know that he had had relations with women until recently. But he was part of that bohemian culture in New York at the time. You know, it was a very libertine kind of culture where people were trying to throw out some of the sexual mores of the time.
Right. The most interesting thing about bi history for me is that even as historians, as John is, as Ellie is, as I am, a lot of the times these figures we either have been taught were gay or straight, and a lot of them, again, even though we are historians and we are bisexual, we just didn't know anything of their actual orientation or what their romantic and sexual lives might have been. And that's why we're doing these podcasts.
It's very true. I read The Importance of Being Earnest years ago and really didn't quite get it, but I loved it. And I just read it again last year, and it's like it took on a totally new meaning to me. You know,
yeah.
It's amazing. Mm-hmm. It's amazing what we don't know, and I guess that's our goal, is to get that our history out there.
Well, yeah, and Oscar Wilde, in terms of the historic figure, that was at the time in which homosexuality was becoming really criminalized, was one of those really huge cases of the century, when he did have a wife and he had kids and had an affair with really the wrong person, whose father was pretty powerful. But you know, now it's looked at because it was such a sensational trial that really set the pace for criminalizing homosexual acts for a long time. You know, he's really claimed by the gay community.
Wow, this has been fantastic. I appreciate you being on so much. So yes. Much great information.
Yes, it was great. So all the links are going to be provided on the website.
Right. Thank you, Ellie, so much for being with us. Is there anything else you would like to add?
No, I think that's it. Thank you.
Excellent.
It's been great. We can't wait to have you on again. I am kind of a archaeology and a little bit of a history, you know, hobbyist is all the only word I can say. I'm not a buff and I'm not very knowledgeable, but I do love it. So I can't wait to have you back on again.
All right. Thank you. Excellent. Thank you for having me.
Yeah,
you
thanks
bet.
For being here.
All right. And thank you, Eileen and John. Awesome job.
Of course.
Remember, you are not wrong, you are not broken, and you are not alone. You are a human being, and you are bisexual. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
For years, Smith Q&A has been fighting for the rights of trans women to be recognized as female by Smith Admissions. How do we measure womanhood? Is it being assigned to a decent teacher who refers to you with she/her pronouns? Is it living in a liberal high school district that will permit gender marker changes on transcripts? Is it being able to afford a gender specialist? Smith seems to think so. Now, after finally meeting with Smith Admissions officials, Q&A has been informed that only now are the Smith Board of Trustees taking up the question of changing policy to include trans women, and plan on meeting to discuss by January 2015 at the earliest. This means the earliest class to include trans women would be the graduating class of 2020. This is unacceptable, and we need to make it clear to the Board of Trustees. You can help us by using our email and phone script at smith-q-and-a.tumblr.com and signing our petition at change.org. It's been too long. Trans women belong.
The views expressed on the Bicast do not necessarily represent those of Binet USA or the Bicast crew.